Good morning. We welcome you all to the courtroom, but especially students from Wayland Academy. The students from Wayland, please stand. Oh my goodness, big group. Thank you. You may be seated. Students are here with a program, a national award-winning program, that is sponsored by this court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students across the country are invited, not across the country, we limit it to the state. Students across the state are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, they're sent materials about this case, and they may engage in some activities relating to the case. They come to court, they listen to the oral argument, and at the end of the second oral argument in the morning, the students can and do often meet with a justice who's been assigned to meet with them for that day. The discussion at the lunch hour relates to the procedure of the court in accepting and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case they are about to hear. And everyone is invited to come to that session. Does anyone need a summary of the case we are about to hear? If so, you raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. Let me introduce the members of the court to you. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Justice Ziegler is the justice with whom you will meet after this case is completed. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left is Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our second case for today, which is 10AP2942D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John Kenyatta Riley. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Riley is Paul R. Erickson. Mr. Erickson.
May it please the court, Attorney Price, Mr. Riley. I've asked for argument on this case because of what I perceive to be significant issues relating to the conduct of litigators. I've been a litigator for 30 years, and this case raises concerns on my part of what the duties and responsibilities are of a litigator in a setting, and in this case, in an underlying case involving the Office of Lawyer Regulation. As you know, the underlying case had a reinstatement hearing at which Brian Polk was the subject matter, and he was trying to be reinstated after allowing his license to lapse. And the critical questions in those cases related to his fitness to be a lawyer. And this court appointed Judge Flynn as a referee and specified three particular issues to examine. Mr. Polk had a lengthy traffic citation history, had a very suspicious loitering claim against him, and numerous civil judgments. The matter was filed by Mr. Polk pro se on his own behalf without Mr. Riley's involvement. Late in the game, Mr. Riley was asked to render moral support and or be a second chair. This is in July of 2006. Hearings in early September of 2006. Mr. Riley, and I believe the findings of the fact of referee Dugan conclude that Mr. Riley's involvement was minimal. He was not involved in the early stages of the petition for reinstatement. He had little to no involvement even after filing a notice of retainer. The referee in this case, referee Dugan, made a finding number 20, that the representation did not include Attorney Riley's preparation of the witnesses, drafting of the petition, prior review of the record, strategy sessions, or consultation, solicitation of testimony based on this restatement trial's court-ordered standards, attention to or analysis to answers of questions. That's a finding of fact made by Referee Dugan.
Counsel, it's my understanding, though, that at the hearing itself, Attorney Riley was the primary attorney doing the direct and cross-examination of all the witnesses. Is that correct?
First of all, there's minimal witnesses.
Right.
And the very specific question at issue here is a question asked by Attorney Riley in direct exam, which is an open-ended question saying, what sort of jobs did you do?
Yeah.
There's no evidence in the case that contradicts the finding of fact that I just read to you from Referee Dugan.
Let me focus on my concern. I heard the beginning of your statement to be you were doing this, had been a long time litigator, and you want to know, you know, what the contours are of the obligation of someone. So I took that to mean, you know, here's an attorney who's not involved in part of the case, limited as the finding 20 indicates, but then really conducted the actual hearing, doing the direct and cross, making the objections, making the closing statement. So is that what your focus is going to be, or did I get a miscue at the beginning and that's not what your focus is going to be?
No, I think it's part of the package here, because there's a lot of attorneys out there that have limited involvement but come up at hearings. And I think you're all aware that our public defenders are stretched, mm-hmm. and they handle a lot of things that are handed to them the day of or whatever. And what happened with OLR and Mr. Riley in this case, I think, is of grave importance to those folks, because even though there may be questions asked, we litigators, there's a lot of our boilerplate questions that flow out that is kind of routine. You know, who are you? Are you married? Do you have kids? Where do you live? What do you do? And that's really part of what happened here is Mr. Riley said, what have you been doing?
Well, wasn't the question, where have you worked? And I know you touched on it earlier, but can you tell the court what kinds of jobs you've had since the loss of your license? What have you done? That was, and isn't the underlying inquiry in the Polk case in part whether or not he has been doing legal work during his suspension?
Well, that I would disagree with, okay. Because now I think you're going beyond what the court asked Judge Flynn to do.
Okay.
So, you know, whether it's background information, what you've been doing since you let your license lapse, the standard that I'm concerned about as a litigator, which I think a lot of people are going to be concerned about, is does the fact that a question is asked mean that you're going to impute actual knowledge of what the answer should be to the lawyer asking the question? Because I don't think that you're going to find many people that are going to agree with that. In this case, where you're asking questions like that, and the noticed issues for hearing don't have anything to do with employment, you roll through it, you move on. You get to the issues that you're there for the hearing on.
Does it make any difference that there's an assertion that Attorney Riley was also working at the Eisenberg firm that allegedly Attorney Polk was doing law-related work at? Does that make any
sense? Well, let me answer that two different ways. One is the referee Dugan in footnote 4, explained that she found Attorney Riley's explanation about the surroundings he found himself in late 05, early 06 to be plausible. And that is that he's not a PI lawyer, which the firm is a PI firm. High volume, lots of stuff going on, people in and out. Rat's maze of an office. In fact, Mr. that might be a poor phrase, but Mr. Riley had two offices that he's splitting time between, and between his criminal practice and bankruptcy, he's not in the office that much. And that was found to be plausible. So you can't impute purely because he's working there that he knows who Mr. Eisenberg's been hiring. And I think that gets to the nub of the second point, which is you still have to prove in a case where you're suggesting that an attorney is offering false testimony, you have to prove actual knowledge. And it's tied into the burden of proof, the clear and convincing standard, the middle burden. And we've got testimony, and I think it's focused dead on Mr. Polk by referee Dugan, and he is all over the board as to whether he talked, when he talked, what he said, what Mr. Riley knew. And I've asked the marshal to give you some copies of various pages of both the deposition and the hearing transcript where it can't be more clear that Mr. Polk is highly contradictory in his responses to that.
Now, part of your argument, of course, is that, as I understand it, the whole issue of where he worked was irrelevant because this was an administrative inactivity and trying to get his license back rather than a discipline one. Is that correct?
That issue goes to materiality, which there's, as I think you're aware, there's an argument that somehow Mr. Riley had a duty to remediate false testimony. That rule specifically refers solely to material evidence. And so we don't believe that the employment issue, given this court's order to Judge Flynn, was material and therefore didn't, even if he knew, which we're not conceding, but even if he knew that Mr. Polk was doing some paralegal, glorified paralegal duties, that he had a duty to remediate. And with respect to what you're saying, the difference between Rule 22 and 31 is critical because when this is not a gentleman who lost his license because he was raiding an IOLTA account or he was deceiving clients or was committing criminal acts that this court then revoked or suspended his license. This is somebody who didn't do his CLEs. And if he had been asked to, or if he had thought to reinstate sooner, he just has to do the CLEs and bang, he's back in. But because he waited too long, there's a fitness and character issue raised. That's where materiality comes in. The standards under 22 are different. Because if you're suspended for gross, well, I shouldn't say gross, but for misconduct, then you can't be working in a law-related activity. Under 22, it's just a CLE issue. And then he can work in a law-related activity. The hearing kind of went askew there about whether or not Mr. Polk was representing himself to third parties as an attorney or not. And in the packet I gave you, there's very, I think, clear testimony from Mr. Polk that, number one, he didn't talk about it, but if he did, it was when he was working at the firm. And then later on, he said, no, it wasn't when I was at the firm. It was sometime after Mr. Riley picked up the gauntlet and was going to help me. But then at the same time, he said, well, we never prepped. We never strategized. We never talked. He was just a body. And that testimony is in your packet as well. So it is an important issue as to materiality, and we're not conceding that Mr. Riley knew any of that at the time. And in fact, his testimony is crystal clear that the first time he heard that Mr. Polk was an employee was after OLR already had a grievance filed against somebody else suggesting that Mr. Polk was working at the Eisenberg firm, and then he investigated it. And to show the catch-22 here, OLR is saying, well, at that time he should have remediated it. Well, he learned it from OLR. So what's he supposed to do? Turn around and say, okay, now what? I mean, it's kind of ludicrous. But that's why I'm concerned as a litigator what's going on here. The rules are changing after the hearing. The referee Dugan suggested that there was a specific hybrid duty referenced in this court's order. It's not there. It's just simply not there. The 2231 issue is hybrid duty. You're not going to find it. I don't know where she came up with it. But regardless, you can't apply that standard after the hearing to Mr. Riley.
Could I ask, is the duty of a criminal defense attorney, public defender or otherwise, different from the duty of someone who's not in a criminal case, such as this case, in terms of what I'm really trying to say is I kind of suspect that there are public defenders who have at some point learned that their clients said something on the stand that wasn't true. What is their remedial obligation? And is that remedial obligation different from a civil attorney?
I don't think it's different, but again, it hinges on materiality. What did the person testify to? How does it relate to the proceeding that you're in? I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's the same whether you're civil or criminal. And we, I think we cited to a restatement on part of this issue. You know, it goes to the actual knowledge. Even if I believe my client's not telling the truth, if I don't actually know that he's committing perjury, I don't think I have an obligation to do anything.
I thought there was a series of cases that if he's entitled to take the stand, but what you don't do as counsel is ask direct questions that you know that the client is going to lie about, and what you do is just let him tell a narrative. I thought that was the way the lawyer avoided the issue of omitting or encouraging or being a party to the client not telling the truth.
Well, I've seen references to the narrative form.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when we dug into that to try and find out what that really means, mm-hmm. it was less than clear in the law.
Oh, I'm sure. But this has been debated in the criminal law arena, and attempts have been made to, on the one hand, not have the officer of the court be a party to perjury, and on the other hand, the defendant has a right to take the stand.
And I can't speak to too much detail about it because there's not a lot of law on that, except that I think all the trial courts that I've talked to about this case have said the same, that there's a lot of instances where lawyers, especially in the criminal setting, know that their client's probably going to get up there and say something that's not true, and they do it in a non-leading form. Getting back to this case, I don't think this is a leading question. And one of the things that's important is that Mr. Polk agreed there were no prep sessions, there were no consultations, there was no strategizing about what he was going to do. So in that circumstance, Mr. Riley said, "What have you been doing since your license lapsed?" It's up to Mr. Polk, who's trying to become a lawyer and adhere to the standards, to tell the truth. And the absent proof of actual knowledge that Mr. Riley knew that what he was saying was false, Mr. Riley has no duty to do anything. And unfortunately, what happened here is after the fact, and in a very strange setting, the client is turning around and saying, "Well, I think I talked to him. I believe I talked to him." Well, no, I really didn't. He should have known, and you'll see in the materials I gave you, how he's flip-flopped all over the place on this, and that's the risk to a litigator when somebody gets angry. Because after the fact, they can come up and say anything. And in this case, not only is Mr. Polk an admitted perjurer, not only did referee Flynn recommend that he not be reinstated because he's not truthful, Judge Flynn also projected out, saying, "I don't think we should reinstate him because I don't think he can adhere to the standards in the future." So referee Dugan had all of that in front of her when she's evaluating whether or not to believe Mr. Polk. And when you see the analysis, and this is the second issue as a litigator I'm very concerned about, is it appears that the referee paid lip service to the burden of proof, this concept of clear and convincing evidence. The the reasoning, if you want to call it that, in the decision as to why Mr. Polk should be believed is because he's allegedly consistent, which is the furthest thing from the truth.
Didn't she also say that he was giving statements against interest and there was other indicia of reliability?
And that's a great point, because when you look at the transcript, Referee Dugan is suggesting that over the objection of counsel, Mr. Polk is testifying. Mr. Polk had already been deposed by the counsel for OLR. He hadn't interjected a concern about attorney-client privilege at all. And at the hearing, when you see what Attorney Schneidman suggested, he said, this could involve attorney-client communication. That's not an instruction not to answer, and it's not Mr. Polk suggesting, this could hurt me, but I'm going to testify anyway. In fact, the only reason that I can conceive of why Mr. Polk was now committing perjury, I think, several more times, is because he's trying to curry favor with the OLR that objected to his reinstatement in the first place. And Referee Dugan doesn't broach that subject at all. The evidence as to Mr. Polk's dishonesty, and it's interesting because as I was preparing for this, somebody said, Mr. Polk doesn't know the truth. He can't even spell it. The truth is that he will say and do anything in the context of one hearing or one deposition. And you can see that in the pages that I just cut out for you and highlighted. You know, the first one in the packet, you testified to two facts that lead you to believe that Mr. Riley knew you were employed at the firm. And it was circumstantial stuff, not a discussion. And he was,
just let me interrupt you just a minute. Are you saying that because Mr. Polk was suspended because he didn't do a CLE, that he could have worked, say, as a paralegal in the firm, so he could have been in the firm in and out, but still not acting as a lawyer?
Not practicing law. The prohibition is practicing law.
So he can
do
work
the other
as
things.
A paralegal. He could do some things under the supervision of a lawyer like paralegals do all the time.
Absolutely.
So the fact that he was in and out of the firm without more doesn't really tell you what role he was playing, correct?
True.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think when you see the testimony from Mr. Riley, keep in mind this is the offshoot of the old Weigel, Eisenberg, Weigel, LeBlanc, and Clemens firm, which is a much bigger operation. But people from the former firm, after the split, were circulating through. They were stopping in for any number of reasons, and Mr. Riley said, I thought he was there to work on his reinstatement. There's, I don't think, any dispute that I believe Mr. Polk's own testimony, it's in the pages in front of you, it agreed he never talked shop with Mr. Riley because Mr. Riley's practice was much different than everybody else.
Can you explain to me, please, why the standard is practicing law rather than law-related activity?
But when I was trying to discern the difference, it occurred to me that, because I remember graduating with somebody who never took the bar and didn't even get sworn in. So they got a law degree. Why is that person not allowed to be a paralegal? Why is somebody who graduates from college not allowed to be a paralegal? Well, they are. So if you don't do your CLEs, why should you be treated any different than a college graduate or a law school grad who never got admitted to the bar in the first place? On the other hand, you better not practice law if you've been suspended, limited, or revoked by this court for misconduct. And then you should stay away from law firms because there's a reason that you shouldn't be in a law-related activity. And I think that's why it's more expanded. I hope that answered that question. The last issue that I wanted to touch, and I don't know how much time I have left, is this clearly erroneous standard on review. We're digging to try and find out what that really means. The best definition that we could find is United States versus United States Gypsum 33 U.S. 364, cited in Blacks. And it's said a finding is clearly erroneous when, although there is evidence to support it, the reviewing court on the entire evidence is left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been committed. I think when you look at this transcript in the record in this case, and when you see what the referee did in terms of creating hybrid standards that don't appear anywhere in this court's orders, when it creates scenarios that just simply don't exist, where she accused Mr. Riley of somehow misusing this court's resources, when this court was told early on after the hearing that Mr. Riley was no longer involved, I don't know how to explain where that stuff comes from. And it certainly suggests to me that a mistake's been committed and needs this court's attention. And I can't more strongly dispute this concept that Mr. Polk was consistent and credible. It's simply not consistent with the record. If you skip over the I don't knows, I don't recalls, the direct denials, and you focus on one Q&A, perhaps, but that doesn't seem to be an appropriate analysis of the evidence in a case with this serious a consequence. Consider Mr. Riley is going to have the scarlet letter going for it as a litigator, as a person appearing in bankruptcy court, criminal court. Suddenly he's got a public reprimand suggesting that he offers false testimony based on the testimony of an admitted perjurer, someone that Judge Flynn told you can't trust, and a person who couldn't have been more inconsistent between his deposition and the hearing. And it certainly doesn't satisfy the clear and convincing standard, and I would ask that you dismiss the complaint. And we actually did this twofold. We moved for summary judgment, which I think should have been granted, but even if you look at the final record, I think it still should be, this complaint should be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Representing the OLR is Matthew Price.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Matthew Price, counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. This case strikes at the heart of the attorney disciplinary system in Wisconsin because it goes to the conduct of a lawyer representing another in an attorney disciplinary proceeding. In this case, Mr. Riley, while representing Mr. Polk in his reinstatement trial, knowingly offered, allowed, and assisted Mr. Polk's false and incomplete testimony, which concealed his employment in Mr. Riley's law firm while he was suspended.
Counselor, is there anything in the record that you know of that shows his presence in the law firm was known by Mr. Riley to be practicing law rather than acting as a paralegal?
I do. In addition to, there was testimony from Mr. Polk at the trial itself, the disciplinary trial, in addition to the deposition, that he had a direct conversation with Mr. Riley about his presenting himself as a lawyer while being employed at the firm. So the evidence presented at the trial was that the nature of the conversation between Mr. Riley and Mr. Polk was not just simply the employment, but it was further that he was actually presenting himself as an attorney at the firm.
Okay, so aside from Mr. Polk's statement, is there anything else that's in the record? In other words, another member of that firm that might have heard them talking, or Mr. Riley's reviewing perhaps the timesheets and what was done of Mr. Polk, anything like that?
In terms of specifically the practicing law part?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Not in the trial record. There was additional testimony in addition to the conversation between Mr. Polk and Mr. Riley. Mr. Polk had also testified that it was common office knowledge amongst all members of the staff, including Mr. Riley, again, not just as to the fact that Mr. Polk was employed doing just regular employment work, but also practicing law on behalf of the firm.
Okay. Okay, so that's, again, Mr. Pope's testimony. I'm just wondering if there's anything else in the record besides his testimony that links Mr. Riley to actual knowledge that he was serving as a lawyer advising clients.
I don't believe there is, but I think that goes to the point which I think was discussed extensively during the beginning of this oral argument, which is I don't believe that is the standard that we are governed by in this proceeding, which is the need to be practicing law as the nature of the violation here for Mr. Polk to be reinstated.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I believe that under the Supreme Court rules and the Supreme Court's precedent, that under the rules that it would be prohibited for Mr. Polk to have practiced law or engaged in law-related work. Under Supreme Court Rule 31.10 sub 1, which is the Supreme Court rule expressly dealing with CLE suspensions, that prohibits practicing law during a CLE suspension. However, this court in disciplinary proceedings against Scanlon, the 2006 case, this court applied Supreme Court Rule 22.26 to Mr. Scanlon's administrative suspension, and that's exactly the type of suspension that Mr. Polk was under. And as a result, by applying 22.26, in this case it was 22.26 sub 1 to Mr. Scanlon, I think we can apply that to this case as well. And 22.26 sub 2 prohibits a lawyer from engaging not only in the practice of law while suspended, but also prohibits a lawyer from engaging in the practice of law-related work, including that of a law clerk, as well as paralegal work. So much is made by way of argument that Mr. Polk was only acting as a glorified paralegal, and we've heard that repeated over and over and over again, such that if that was the box that Mr. Polk was put into, it would have no impact on the hearing. It would have not made any difference, and it wouldn't have constituted a violation. And I believe that whether he was acting as a paralegal or practicing law, that would have constituted a major violation in terms of his ability to demonstrate that he had the proper character and fitness to resume the practice of law.
Thank you.
I haven't reread the Scanlon case. Is that the name of the case you're citing? Does that opinion hit this issue head on? By that, I mean our Supreme Court rules, SCR 3110, deals with noncompliance of CLE. And it specifically says, a lawyer shall not engage in the practice of law in Wisconsin while his or her state bar membership is suspended under this rule. You're right that SCR 22.26 sub 2 indicates, which is headed activities following suspension or revocation, that an attorney who's licensed to practice is suspended or revoked can't engage in the practice or law-related activity. My question is, does that case deal with the difference between those two rules and why the more broad 22.26 should apply than the specific 31.10?
I don't believe that Scanlon expressly deals with the distinction between the 31.10 sub 1 issue in terms of why it would override or take a broader stance as to not applying, looking at the prohibition against practicing law as the exclusive prohibition for CLE suspension. However, I believe it really doesn't matter in this instance which is the standard or the limitation, because the point is that whether it was the inability to just practice law or whether it was the inability to practice law-related work, either of those things would have reflected whether it was the broader standard or the narrower standard. That was precisely what the Office of Lawyer Regulation was seeking to investigate in the underlying Polk case. And it was Riley's conduct that interfered with its ability to investigate exactly what Polk was doing and whether Polk had the ability and the character and fitness to resume the practice of law. So Mr. Riley interfered with that. So I think finding out what he was doing and what the limitations were was really where the misconduct was, not ultimately what he was precluded from doing. So I think the answer is I think the limitation is broader. I think Scanlon does provide the jumping board, the more narrower or the more broader focus to prohibit the law-related work. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, it really, I don't think we have to get to that point, because I think either way the issue is even before that door opens to determine is it A or is it B. Both of those doors were locked, and Mr. Riley was the one who had the key.
Could I ask, when Mr. Riley asked the question, which is in part, what have you done, and gets the answer that doesn't include any practice of law for the Eisenberg firm, what is the remedial step that you say he should have taken?
Well, I think that if you take a look at the comments to 3.384, he's got the obligation to immediately remediate the testimony. And I think in terms of a practical step, what he should have done, sort of trying to put myself in his shoes, is I think I would have asked for a brief adjournment and explained to my client at that point what the obligations were. And I think the obligation at that point in time would be to advise my client that he has an obligation to either himself correct that misstatement, or else Mr. Riley would have to inform the court at that time of his statement for him. And the comment makes quite clear that simply withdrawing from the case is not an option if it wouldn't remedy that false or incomplete testimony. So there's no doubt that it puts the attorney in a tough bind. But you can't just let that false testimony out there and linger. And there's no case that I've been able to find from Wisconsin that deals with the exact procedure or the exact timing. I did find a case that I would draw to your attention from the Idaho Supreme Court called Idaho State Bar versus Warwick at 44 Pacific 3rd, 1141, where a prosecutor was disciplined for not immediately remedying false testimony that he knowingly offered. He was going to remedy it the next day, and the court found that that wasn't fast enough. It had to be done right then and there, and it wasn't done. But that duty has to be done right then and there. And I just, to dovetail with that, you had raised the question earlier about the differing duties, or are there any differing duties with the criminal defense bar? And turning to the comments of the rule, they recognize the tension with regard to representation of a criminal defendant and identify the questions and the concerns that I think that you had raised, but certainly don't resolve them. So I do think there's a recognition of a distinction without a great resolution.
Does this rule, do some of these rules apply to political candidates? Who are attorneys?
I believe they do. I mean, I think that lawyers, these rules go with lawyers in whatever context that they're doing. And in terms of political campaigns, I think that would apply in the context of political campaigns as well. There's not a limitation on the rules. I think the issue of materiality, I think, is an interesting one. I disagree with appellant's counsel in terms of the issue of materiality as well. If we look at the first component of 3.3A4, the rule is broken down into two mutually exclusive components. And the first part of that rule says a lawyer shall not knowingly offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. There is no materiality component to that first provision of the rule that is totally different than the second component. Materiality is not at issue in deciding whether a lawyer violates this rule.
Does the question here fit within the language that you have just read of offering evidence? It's a pretty broad, open-ended question that was posed to Mr. Polk.
Absolutely, and that is because if you look at the restatement section 120, comment D, tells us that not only does the offering of false evidence provide a responsibility to the lawyer for questions that he or she asks of his own client, but questions asked by other lawyers of his own client? And if you take a look at the testimony, the cross-examination questions by OLR counsel of Mr. Polk at his reinstatement hearing, OLR counsel asked specific questions about Mr. Polk's employment history. Did you work for a law firm while you were suspended? Answer, no. Did you perform work as a lawyer while you were suspended? Answer, no. I'm paraphrasing, of course. Did you perform any law-related work? No. He answered specific questions, and under the restatement, makes it clear that Mr. Riley, in addition to being responsible for his own questions, is responsible for those responses to those questions posed by other lawyers of his own client as well. So I think, in addition to his own questions, which I don't agree were particularly open-ended, because I think if you look at his question, the first part of it was, tell us about your jobs, and then he closes the question by saying, what have you done? And Mr. Polk proceeds to give a fairly detailed list of his employment, and a glaring omission was his work at Eisenberg and Riley, which, as far as I know from the record, in terms of the time frame, was the history that most recently preceded that hearing. Mr. Polk testified.
So the witness has to not only tell the truth, but the whole truth. Is that right?
I think if the attorney asks a question soliciting information about his employment and omits something that the lawyer knows to be false, the answer is yes.
Is there precedent for the OLR going after any public defenders under these sections?
There may be, but I'm not aware of any.
Or politicians.
Now, isn't this limited to evidence? Why are we talking about politics? Doesn't this limit to evidence?
Well, it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, and that's part of what you're hanging your hat on here, isn't it?
Well, I think that's one of the additional, that's one of the violations that we're charging in addition to the other substantive counts.
What's the oath that the witness takes?
Excuse me?
What is the oath that the witness takes when the witness testifies?
In terms of swearing to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
Says the whole truth.
The whole truth.
Not part of it.
Correct.
Whole truth.
That's correct.
Leaving out an omission can be a misrepresentation.
I believe it can, yes.
Was Mr. Riley compensated for this representation?
I do not believe he was.
What implications, if any, does that have?
None. I believe that, and I think as Justice Bradley pointed out, while there's no dispute that he certainly didn't have a heavy hand in any of the pretrial preparations, he appeared at the hearing, he conducted all the examination, all the opening and closing statements, he conducted the entire trial as if he was, and he was, lead counsel. I mean, there can always be agreements between lawyers and their attorneys in terms of roles that they're going to play as long as they're knowingly made and everyone signs off on them. But, you know, you're not allowed to shirk your ethical responsibilities when you're taking the role of leading a hearing. I mean, the second chair status and things like that just simply wasn't the case. If you're going to take on the responsibility of conducting a hearing, the rules of professional responsibility apply regardless of whether you're paid or not.
So when Mr. Polk answered this question, what have you done, from Mr. Riley, your view is that Mr. Riley should have stopped the proceedings at that point and either talk to his client or somehow correct the record?
That's correct. I think either, if not immediately. I mean, it's, you put yourself in the context of the hearing, and it may not be appropriate to necessarily just immediately slam on the brakes. There's practicalities involved, but at the soonest possible point where there'd be a break in the testimony, I think it'd be appropriate to request a brief adjournment and talk to the client, take the client in the hallway, and explain what's happened and what the ethical implications are and what Mr. Riley's duty was at that time to remediate the testimony. Because I do believe, even though for a violation of 3.384, Mr. Riley knowingly offered the false evidence, so that does constitute a violation in itself. The second part of the rule, which is a violation separately, he knowingly offered the material false evidence. It was material, so then it had to be remedied. He had to let Mr. Polk know what his obligations were, which was remediation. And if Mr. Polk wasn't about to go along with the remediation, then yes, Mr. Riley had to do the remediation himself.
Counselor, there were some answers that apparently were false that were made in response to cross-examination. Does Mr. Riley have any obligation to take responsibility for those false answers given in cross-examination?
Well, I think that's part of it. That's part of the violation that was charged sort of together, was the fact that he offered the false evidence by asking the questions himself, and also offered it via the cross-examination questions asked by OLR counsel on cross-examination. But then also the evidence offered was material, and he didn't remedy the question that he asked and offered the evidence through that, and he didn't remedy the false evidence offered through OLR's cross-examination.
And he's got to be a policeman, and if false evidence is given in response to cross-examination,
yes,
he still has an obligation to remedy that problem, even though he didn't answer the question.
Absolutely. I'll just quote, basically, Restatement Section 120, Comment D, says that offering false evidence extends to any false testimony elicited by the lawyer, as well as such testimony elicited by another lawyer questioning the lawyer's own client.
Have we a case that says that a lawyer is responsible for remedying false testimony given in cross-examination?
As far as I've been able to tell, the court has not adopted that comment to the restatement. Another comment to that restatement section has been adopted dealing in the criminal context by the Court of Appeals in a case called State versus McDowell, but not by this court with regard to that particular comment.
Okay, thank you.
Counselor, are you a litigator?
Yes.
Have you ever met with a client before a deposition and told them, you know, you're going to be asked a series of questions. I want you to be really careful and listen to the question asked. Just answer whatever the question asked is. You don't need to offer additional information. Right? I mean, that wouldn't be atypical for a lawyer to say that to a client.
Of course.
So now, if I'm understanding you correctly, lawyers can't instruct their clients to do that anymore, because if a question asked evokes an answer that really ends up being somewhat misleading unless you answer it explaining all the circumstances surrounding that answer, then the lawyer better stop, interject, and explain all the circumstances surrounding that answer, even though the answer is yes. But it's yes because of X, Y, and Z.
I mean,
do you see what I'm saying? There are a lot of times that the answer to a question can be truthful, yet still could be misleading.
Well, that's true, but it's hard to answer without the context. If you're talking about a yes or no question, I think if someone asks you a question and the answer is yes or no, and I think you can answer yes without giving the extended explanation beyond the yes. But I guess the question, I guess if you're asked a question to list items or give an explanation, and you omit a critical portion of it, I think that's a whole different set of circumstances.
Well, I can see a whole group of facts under which a client may truthfully answer a question, but because it may have been unartfully asked, yet leave the person who asked the question with the impression that, that there's really nothing further to be discussed on this issue. Just think of any sort of scenario. You know, did you see Dr. Brown regarding your broken arm? Well, no, Dr. Brown didn't have the name Dr. Brown at the time because Dr. Brown wasn't yet married or something. So the answer is no, I didn't see Dr. Brown about that. I mean, that's really a truthful answer, yet the lawyer better jump in and say, well, Dr. Brown wasn't yet married. Dr. Brown was then Dr. whatever. And really the answer to this question is yes. I mean, you end up, well, it could be a whole series of questions. I mean, you can imagine hundreds of questions and scenarios. On this particular date, did you do X, Y, and Z? Well, no, but it was actually midnight, so it was the next date. Sure, I mean, is the lawyer supposed to step in and say, well, it really, I mean, I don't want to mislead you here. It was 12 o'clock. It wasn't 11:58.
But I would imagine, though, that if really the goal, at least, in theory, for discovery purposes, like you're suggesting, is to provide information and hopefully truthful information.
No evidence. It's testimony.
It is. And I would think that the purposes would be best served by providing the most complete and truthful and accurate information. And I think if an answer would be changed by the fact that someone gave bad information that someone knew was false, that it would be appropriate then to require them to make the correction.
If it's false, but I mean, okay.
Knowingly false, and that's the higher standard that we're dealing with here, is it's not just a function of false information, is does the lawyer know it's false?
Counsel, seems to me that you're a little broader than you need to be. You have three rules here. The first rule that's violated is 20-point alleged violation, 20.3.3A4. And it says, a lawyer shall not knowingly offer the evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. Okay, so you say to that first sentence, there's no materiality.
Correct.
If it's false, it's false. The second sentence of that rule, though, does employ materiality, and it says, if the lawyer has offered material evidence and comes to know of its falsity, then you got to take remedial action. So the lawyer is offering evidence, and it has to be material, and you have to take action. You seem to be taking that second sentence and importing it into the two other alleged violations by your use of, if it comes up on cross-examination. And why are you doing that? Or what's the basis of you doing that?
Well, I mean,
do you understand my question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that that with regard to the 3.4B charge and the 8.4C charge, mm-hmm. I would disagree with regard, I think a little bit with regard to the 8.4 C charge. But with regard to the 3.4B charge,
and that charge is a lawyer shall not falsify evidence, counsel, or assist a witness to testify falsely or offer inducement to testify falsely.
And I mean,
students know what we're talking about.
Right. And I think that under that rule, you know, Olar is not taking the position that Mr. Riley had actively coached or advised Mr. Riley to offer that false evidence. It's basically what Mr. Riley was obligated to do but did not do that constitutes the violation. It's a passive violation, which this court's approved in Nick Meyer and other cases. Passive violations are approval, and I think it is the eliciting of the testimony, the lack of eliciting the corrective testimony that I do think largely serves as the basis for it. So I would agree that with respect to the 3.4B violation, it does largely hooked to the second component of the 3.3A4 charge. So there is some commonality certainly there. But I do think with respect to the 8.4C charge, the misconduct for conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, that easily is related to both components of the 3.3A4 charge, both the knowingly offering false evidence, that certainly constitutes misconduct under 8.4C, as does his failure to remediate the materially false evidence that he offered.
So does he get, under your theory, three violations that we should consider in the discipline? Or because it's one course of conduct and he violates three provisions, is it one violation?
Well, and I think that's a good question. I think that's the reason why it was decided by the PRC to charge this as one combined count for violation of all three rules, because there is the admitted commonality. So that's why they were all charged together.
Because I always, at least in our prior cases, and when I looked at C, engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, I thought of a criminal charge or tort charge against somebody for misrepresentation, et cetera. I didn't see that if you told your kid a misrepresentation, you'd be charged as a professional violation.
Yes, yeah. Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
Exactly. That it would have to be a misrepresentation in the basis of client and in the basis of a professional conduct, but on the commonality. So you've got one series of acts, one charge, and you agree it should be a public reprimand?
I do. I mean, I think if we take a look at the sanctioned cases that we've cited that sort of frame the appropriate sanction, there's sort of three cases that we cited too. I think the sort of most extreme case is the Aaliyah case, where Mr. Aaliyah had falsified an exhibit for use by a witness. He was suspended for 90 days. I think that's a little bit extreme. I think the Kahlo case, the 2002 case, where Mr. Kahlo made the representation of this court during oral argument about his firm's disciplinary sanction, I think that's sort of the closest thing that we have to match.
I somehow think that the discipline is related to the effect of the misconduct. So here we've got a procedure on reactivation of a lawyer's license, and there's a question whether he told the full truth. Okay, public reprimand. But suppose there's a misrepresentation and not telling the whole truth, and somebody goes to prison for a lot of years. You think that would affect the sanction?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that would be worth considering too. Sure. I mean, I think without speaking for the determination made by the director of OLR, I would suppose that that would be a consideration, an aggravating factor that would be considered, that would likely lead to, depending on a prior disciplinary history, a more extreme sanction. We do have a prior private reprimand here from 2009 as well to consider. And so we believe that, all told, that a public reprimand is the most appropriate sanction.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Counsel?
First of all, there's nothing in the record that Mr. Polk was practicing law. The testimony was, did he have concerns about holding himself out to third parties, as an attorney? That's the only thing you'll find in the record. And what you'll see, in the pages that I gave you, when you were asked about testimony or evidence on this, page 2. He denies having any specific facts that would demonstrate Mr. Riley's knowledge that he was holding himself out as an attorney. Page 3. Did you ever hear Mr. Riley discuss with anybody? Did I ever hear? No. Did you ever hear him directly discuss it with anybody? Did you ever discuss it with him? It being your presenting yourself as an attorney to third parties. Answer, I can't say that I had that direct conversation with him, no. That's Mr. Polk. There's several more pages of this. It's the same thing. The next page, page 4, he said, if I had that discussion, it was back when I was filing my petition to reinstate, when I was employed at the firm. Then at the hearing, at the bottom of that same page, he's asked, well, if you did have that conversation, when did it take place? No, no, it was when I was preparing for the hearing after I wasn't employed at the firm anymore. Page 6. Did you ever discuss with Mr. Riley at any point before the post-June 23, 2006, your concerns about presenting yourself as an attorney during the course of your employment at Eisenberg Riley? Answer, I don't recall. Bottom of the same page, he admits, we never discussed this strategy, which circles back to this idea you're charging Mr. Riley with offering false evidence. He asked an open-ended question after no strategy sessions, no counseling sessions, no prep meetings, and supposedly he's offering false testimony. In fact, counsel, when he was arguing with you, said, well, what he should do then is try to remediate it. He's going to Part B of that rule right away. What do? You call a timeout, you talk to your client, and then you have to remediate. That's what counsel said. And keep in mind, this is the same lawyer you asked, is he a litigator? He put Kerry Ingram on the stand. Kerry Ingram got on the stand and said, while I was an employee, I typed up a phone list that had Mr. Polk on it. The evidence at the hearing is that the ADP salary records show she was terminated months before Mr. Polk was employed there. But somehow magically she puts his name on a list from the spring of 05. Mr. Polk wasn't even there yet. And what's most telling about that is, well, Mr. Riley's supposed to know that Mr. Polk works at the firm. Well, Mr. Price knew that Kerry Ingram's name wasn't even on the employee list. She's the one who typed it up. She says, I was an employee then. Now, if somebody has a duty to remediate, and I'm not suggesting Mr. Price committed any misconduct, because how material was it? You know, he hasn't done anything since the hearing to remediate that testimony. Why? Because he won. Just like in the Polk matter, Mr. Polk lost. And all of this discussion about, well, you should remediate something that wasn't really material anyway, in a case where you lost, it's silly. That's why litigators have to be concerned about an expansion of the rule like OLR is espousing in this case. We can't guarantee the truth of everything a witness says, and if it's off point, why are we going to be spending time dealing with it, saying, oh, wait, it doesn't really have anything to do with this case, but I have to take a time out, drag my client out in the hall and correct it because he gave the wrong address or he got the doctor's name wrong. You don't do that because it's not material and it's a waste of time. And you don't remediate it after you lose. I mean, what's the point? And you certainly don't remediate it after you're informed by the very body you'd report it to that he was employed at the firm. It just doesn't work that way. And that's why we have to bring some reality and common sense back into these rules. Mr. Riley didn't offer anything. Mr. Price offered a list. There should have been great skepticism about that list when the author of the list wasn't even on it. That's offering evidence. That didn't happen here. There's no evidence of actual knowledge. The best you get is some circumstantial contradictory evidence of what Mr. Riley might have known. Mr. Polk's testimony was, I believe he knew, because I thought everybody knew. That's what OLR is basing a public reprimand that's going to follow Mr. Riley around forever, suggesting that he's engaged in dishonest conduct. It's not him. Mr. Polk is the one who chose to commit perjury. And this idea of remediating something is It's not material, which is what requires you to remediate. So that just didn't happen. And I would ask that you don't expand this rule and bring some reality and common sense back to this. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I, on behalf of the court, want to thank both the counsels, Mr. Erickson and Mr. Price, for their argument in this lawyer discipline case. These cases are always very difficult for the lawyer involved and the lawyers representing the respondent and the OLR and for the court. So we appreciate your arguments and your brief. This ends our argument in 10AP2942D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John Kenyatta Riley. The court will be in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third argument for the day. The students may remain here and the justice will be out shortly to talk with them. We are in recess.